That's when I just want to say, hey, Gretchen, can you come back up here and do that one more time? One more time. Loved it. Thank you so much for gifting us with your gifts. And talking about gifts and gifting, and all of us are doing that right now. I know you are. We're shopping. We're ordering. We're wrapping. We're doing all that stuff. That's just what we do at this time of year. I just want to say that we have a member, and I know that this member would say along with a great group of people, it happens, but we have a member who has a gift for gifting many. And that member is Angela Marcantonio. And Angela Marcantonio heads up our angel tree. And we gift hundreds of gifts for hundreds. I don't know. She could tell you the facts and the figures. And she's got all the numbers. But let me tell you, it seems like hundreds of kids. And we are blessed as a church to be able to go out on one day to gift many families, many children through Angel Tree. You bring in gifts and stuff like that. But yesterday, I'm driving around with my family, and I'm just thanking God for Angela Marcantonio, a person who uses her gifts, her time, and her abilities, and so that we as a church, we can do this. And Angela, I know that you would tell me to thank many others, but I'm not. I'm just going to thank you today, okay? So everybody, Angela's sitting right there, and she's done it year in, year out, but thank her, please. And I miss things left and right. I do. I mean, you better keep a notepad, and you can say you missed this, you missed that. I missed the announcement that we're selling cookies over in the fellowship hall earlier on. So, you know, if you need your cookie fix, go get your cookie fix after church. And I hope there's some cookies left, so you better, like, jet over there right afterwards, because those things go fast. But there's a cookie walk over there, and it benefits people. It's for a great thing, and that's going on over there. And so, welcome to Shine this morning. And we've been talking all month about A Christmas for Everyone. It's been based upon Jesus' family tree. And as we've gone throughout the weeks, we've discussed people who are involved, the ancestors, the genealogy of Jesus. And we discussed our first week, Judah and Tamar. And then we discussed last week, Rahab. So we've been doing this, we've been building, and we're going to do it again today. We're going to look at one of Jesus' ancestors, because these people tell the story of Jesus. These people are a part of the Christmas story. And when we understand them, when we understand who they are, when we understand their story, we so much more understand Jesus' story. And so last week, I opened up by kind of poking fun at my dad and his whole genealogy, his fascination with genealogy. And I'm telling you genealogists rose to the occasion, and you came after me after church, and you assured me it's important, and studying ancestors are important. And I got a business card from someone who does this, and she's like, I can help you out on this. And I got all kinds of offers from genealogists that they rose, and they're like, hey, don't you poke fun at your dad for spending all that time and writing, publishing that book and such. And word got back to my dad that I poked fun at him. Don't know how these things always happen, but word got back to my dad that I poked fun at him. And my dad said, hey, you know, they put your sermons online. You can listen to you. And I went, yeah. And he said, you know what I'm going to do? You think that's fun to poke fun at me and at your church? What I'm going to do is I'm going to pipe in your sermon at my church and show them how disrespectful a son can be at times. And they can listen to you poking fun at me at your church. And so we got a little thing going back and forth. And I love my dad, and I'm proud of my dad, and I claim my dad. And I want my dad at every family event possible. And we were having dinner last Sunday night, and it got out, word got out, and somebody leaked it. One of the family members said, hey, Gramps, did you know dad made fun of you today? And that's how it happened. And I love my dad. I want him at my family table every day of the week. But you know what? The truth is, and I can say this because none of the relatives, but when we talk about families and we talk about relatives, and one of the things that we've been talking about, Matthew, is, and when you talk about genealogy, aren't there some family members you're just really proud of? You love some family members, and you love being with them, and you look forward to being with them for the holidays, right? There are those family members, aren't there? And then aren't there other family members that you just are so thankful that you're three states away and that never happens? I mean, aren't there some family members you're like, you know what? It just, for divine providence and divine reasons, it just never works out that we can be together. But that's okay, because I don't really like them anyways. I'm not proud of them. Right? Don't we have, all of us have some characters in our family that we just are probably better without, or that we're not always proud to claim, and we got that, right? And what Matthew does in the genealogy of Jesus is he says, here comes Jesus. Do you know his family? You need to know his family. In the genealogy of Matthew that he puts forth, and we've talked about this all month, only two gospels deal with Jesus' birth. There's Luke and there's Matthew. Luke's is awesome. Christmas pageant stuff. Matthew's account of Jesus' birth is not, it's not the same as Luke's. It's pretty dry. It's really hard to get through. As a matter of fact, we never really do get through it because we're bored to tears by the sixth verse of the first chapter. And I'll invite you to turn to Matthew as we dive into this section of scripture that I've just told you is usually blaringly boring. But we're going to go with it. And that's where our series has been most of this month. And we've talked about Matthew's genealogy. And the one thing that I've shared about Matthew's genealogy throughout the month is, as you begin to read this genealogy, please understand that this is not a conventional genealogy, that Matthew puts forth the genealogy he's not supposed to put forth, that Matthew includes family members that he doesn't have to include. In Matthew's genealogy, he puts forth four women. He wasn't supposed to put forth any women. In that day and age, you didn't put women in your family's genealogy. And Matthew says, forget that. That's a convention, and that's a custom that I'm not following, because there are women in Jesus' family, and I'm going to put four of them in this record, and you're going to have to deal with them. And so Matthew puts four women in Jesus' genealogy, and they're controversial women. Three of them aren't even Jewish. And then you get to studying their story, and it's dicey. It's rated R kind of stuff, but Matthew's like, there it is. That's the true story. That's the story I'm putting forward. Matthew puts forward the story of Jesus in a real way, in a way that nobody did to that time and nobody has since. It's the best genealogy and it tells a great story. And we're going to dive back in there today to deal with the next character of the story. Now, as we deal with the genealogy and the characters of Jesus' family, I want you to know that each week that we've dealt with these certain family members of Jesus, that each week one of these family members or two of those family members, they have asked us a question. So as we study the next family member today, understand that we are studying him not just for historical purposes, not just so we build up our Christian knowledge bank, not so we can just play Bible trivia on Jeopardy. You know, it's great when we can do that. But what we're studying this person so we can understand the role and the point he plays in Jesus' story. And then this character we study today, he's going to ask us a question. So prepare yourselves as we begin to study this character for this question. Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, please follow with me, and here we go. We're going to dive into week 3 of this series. A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, Isaac the father of Jacob, Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar, Perez the father, hold on, chapter 1, verse 1. A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ. Read the next part very slowly. The son of who? David. A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ. The son of David. What is Matthew doing? What's he doing? And he already starts to do it in the first verse. He already starts to say, you better buckle up, because I'm going to tell you a story of Jesus that you've never heard put this way. And if you listen, if you study my story, it's going to blow you away, because you're going to hear a whole new story, and you're going to understand Jesus like you've never understood him before. So buckle up. And that's what Matthew does right there. A record. How many hundreds of times have we read this? Many times. But check it out. A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David. Isn't there something inside your mind goes, nah, that's not right. That is not right. He should not do that. He is wrong. Who should Matthew say? The son of? And Matthew says, I know his genealogy better than you. I know his story better than you. And I'm going to start it off with the son of David, not the son of Joseph. And that would have gotten everybody's attention from the very start. See, the truth of the matter is, Jesus is most closely associated with everybody in that genealogy that you read. You can read that whole chapter. You can read all 17 verses. But of all those 17 verses in that whole chapter, in that whole genealogy, and all those generations listed, the person that Jesus is most closely associated with is David. David. He has to be. The Messiah had to be of the bloodline of David. And by bloodline of David, it meant this. Not how we understand bloodlines today. This person would have had to be such of the bloodline of David that if David were to live that day, that David and Jesus could actually be father and son. It had to be that type of bloodline, that type of connection. It had to be that close so that Jesus is the son of David. And the Messiah had to come from the bloodline of David. That had to be proven. It had to be true. And Matthew says, this is true. This Jesus, born of Mary and Joseph, is of the bloodline of David. He's so much the bloodline of David, David could be his papa. And that's how I'm going to start. I'm going to say, Jesus is the son of Papa David. And that's where it begins. So Jesus, most closely associated with David, and what's going on here. Then Matthew says, you better know the story of David, because he's Jesus's papa. For all intents and purposes, you better know his story. So do we know the story of David? What we know is that David's story takes place 1,000 years before Jesus. We know that, here's what we know. We know that the prophet Samuel goes to the town of Bethlehem. That's pretty cool, right? 1,000 years before, he goes to the town of Bethlehem. And in Bethlehem, he visits a father, and the father is Jesse. And Jesse has how many sons? He has 8. But when Samuel goes to Jesse's house, Jesse's 7 sons come to Samuel. And Samuel looks him over and he goes, no, 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 no. Not going to cut it. Not going to cut it. Samuel looks at Jesse and he says, you got any more boys? And Jesse looks at Samuel and goes, what's your problem? I got 7 boys. And Samuel says, you got another one? And Jesse goes, I got a little runt. He's the youngest. He's off in the fields being a shepherd. He stinks. And he does the grunt work around here. What, you want to see him? And Samuel says, yeah, I want to see him. And Jesse probably stomped his feet and went, oh, crying out loud. All right, because you're a prophet, I'll go get him. Sends his boys out to the fields to get David. David gets work relief program. Comes to Samuel, stinky, little runt. Samuel looks at him and goes, he's it. Jesse and the brothers go, what do you mean he's it? And Samuel the prophet goes, he's it. He's it. I'm going to anoint him right now. I'm going to anoint him. Now, Jesse and the brothers would have went, okay, this is a joke, right? Samuel takes out the oil given to him and anoints David. And what does he anoint David as? King shepherd boy of Palestine? What does he anoint David as? As now you are the toughest kid of your family? No. No. He says, young David, he says, you know what? I'm going to anoint you. I don't know how it's all going to work out. That's not my problem. My problem is just to do as God tells me to do. I'm going to throw some oil on your head, and I'm going to anoint you as the next king of what? Israel. That story, and we all know that. Samuel anoints him. Amazing story, right? Shepherd boy. Shepherd boy is anointed as king. Don't know how that's going to work out. And we know this. David was very different from King Saul. King Saul was the first king of Israel. We know that David was everything that Saul was not. David was charismatic. He was gifted. Hey, look at the Old Testament stories. The way that they write the stories of Saul are so drab. I mean, it's so depressing to read stories about Saul in the Old Testament. But then the Old Testament writers, you want to talk about David? They'll talk about David all day long. And when they talk about David, they talk about David with so much artistry and literary skill. I mean, even the stories just pour it on David. And you're just like, okay, he's awesome. Because that's how they're written. We know stories of David. Some of the most popular stories we know about King David are, we know that, hey, come on. All of you are down with this, right? All of us love the underdog. What do we know about David? He beats who? He beats Goliath. We love that story. And also, we love another story about David. We love David's story of unconditional friendship with who? A lot of you know that story, right? Saul, King Saul, has a son. His son is Jonathan, right? And David and Jonathan form this friendship. And it becomes an unconditional friendship. They make an oath together that no matter what happens, no matter what goes down, we will always protect, we will always love one another, and we love that story about David and Jonathan. These are the stories that we know. These are the stories that we love. We know David was extraordinary. You know that. Not many shepherds become kings. And he had to have some serious skills. If you read David's stories, he had his serious skills because he rises in prominence in Saul's court as the king's court. He rises to prominence quickly. And what impressed Saul about David also impressed an entire nation. Seriously, an entire nation was impressed with this guy. It got to the point where David was so awesome that in the streets, I mean, and when they say in the streets, they mean right by Saul's palace, the people would shout. Now imagine if you're Saul and you're king, and the people would shout, Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed tens of thousands. Tens of thousands. The people were crazy about David. Not just the people, not just Saul's son, Jonathan. Jonathan was crazy about David, but Saul had a daughter, and she was crazy about David. I mean, she'd be checking David out from that palace, and she'd be seeing this warrior man. She'd be seeing this guy who's rising up through her papa's ranks. She'd be seeing this young guy, and she's like, shoo, not only can he kick tail on the battlefield, not only does everybody love him and every paparazzi's trying to follow this guy. I mean, he plays the harp, so that kind of speaks to my heart, you know? He's musical, he can sing, and what woman doesn't love a man that can't sing and play an instrument? She's like, he is the whole package and so much more of that. And Saul's like, yeah, knock it off. And she's like, I'm serious, Daddy. I'm serious. I am into David. I'm digging David. And Saul was like, yeah, enough of that. And she's like, I'm falling in love. I am falling in love with this man. And so Michal, Saul's daughter, bothered him so much. She actually did. She bothered him so much that Saul says, all right, you love him? I do. I love him. You can have any man in this kingdom, and you want him? I want him, Dad. And Saul's going, oh, brother, my son loves him. Now my daughter loves him. And guess what? Saul's daughter, Michal, marries David. What happens? You know what happens, because you know David's story. Saul's jealousy boils over, and Saul becomes very mad at David. And so what happens? David goes into exile. He runs off into safety, doesn't he? And how many of you are familiar with that? You're familiar with that story? You know that? Saul and David have a falling out. Saul tries to take David's life. David's like, I am hightailing it out of here, okay? Maybe I saw my future and what it was going to be, but the reality says my future is going to be different, and I'm going to the south country. So basically, David flees, and he goes into the hills. I promise you, all these details, all of this will come together. It all is important. And so David flees to the south country, and he hides in the hills. Now, what David does in the south country is very important for us to know. While he's in the south country, half of Israel is in the north, and half is in the south. Six tribes are in the north. Six tribes are in the south. 12 tribes of Israel, right? While David is in exile in the south country, he begins to build relationships with the south tribes, the southern tribes. Now, all this time, the southern tribes have always been neglected. They've been forgotten. They've been the second child. Saul has had nothing to do with them. Saul hasn't given them any grains. He hasn't given them any protection. He collects their taxes, and he does nothing for them. And the south tribes have been neglected for years. And now David's in exile, and what does he begin to do? He begins to build friendships with all these outcasts, with all these forgottens. And pretty soon they like him, and pretty soon what happens is that David becomes their king. David becomes the king of Judah, the southern country, six tribes allegiance. As David becomes the king of the southern tribes, Saul dies. He dies in a battle. Saul's son, Ishbael is lame. He's lame from the day he takes the throne, and people don't take long to go, oh my goodness. Ishbael is now our northern king. He's our king. He is so lame that the chief commander of the king's army, Abner looks at Ishbael and he goes, okay, I'm out of here. You are lame. You can't protect anybody. You are not capable of leading this country, and I'm not going down with you. I'm out of here. And Ishbael, lame king, Abner, the king of the commander's army, where does he go? Where do you think he hightails it to? Who's he going to go to? He goes to David. He hears that David is in the south country. He hears that David is the king of Judah. And he says, I think I'm going to go work for David. And when Abner goes to work for David, and they got a lame king, guess what the six northern tribes say? Guess what they say? They say it's time for a new king. Time to replace Ishbael. And who do they replace Ishbael with? David. And guess what? For the first time ever, the 12 tribes are united into one country and they become Israel. All of this is so important. Now, here's a really cool part to the story. What has kept these tribes isolated? What has kept the southern country and the northern country separate? They've never had a common ground. They've never had a common city. They've never been able to agree on a neutral point. And so David knows that Israel is stronger together than apart. And David says, what we need is we need a capital city. We need a capital city. We need one new city where we can all come together and we can make this kingdom of Israel, God's dream, God's vision, where we can make this dream real. And so what city does David eye? Do you know what today is known as the city of David? What city today in our world is known as the city of David? Jerusalem. Jerusalem is occupied by the Canaanites. The Canaanites have held Jerusalem for many years. And David looks at Jerusalem and he says, that's our capital city. And everybody looks at David and they go, you're crazy. We'll never get that city from the Canaanites. Now, okay, you'll have to indulge me because I get into this stuff. This is pretty cool. David said, we can take the city and this will become our new capital city. And as a new capital city, we'll become a great nation and we'll serve God together. And they say, how? Now, any of you are into special forces? Any of you like army movies? Do any of you like Navy SEAL movies? Do any of you get into that stuff? You're like, yeah, I mean, here you go. David sends some special forces to Jerusalem. And he says, here's what I want you to do. I want you to enter through the water piping, through the aqueducts. I want you to go through the aqueducts. I want you to make your way into the city through the aqueducts. You're going to climb up the aqueducts, and through the aqueducts, you're going to get into the city. And then when you get into the city of Jerusalem, you do your special forces, you do your Israel SEALs, you do your ranger thing, right? And you do that, and you get inside that city, and you take that city, all right? One man, each man special forces, you can take 200 of them. And so by special forces, they enter Jerusalem, and guess what? That's how Jerusalem becomes the holy city. That's how Jerusalem becomes the city of David. David is a military strategist and everybody loves him. Hey, guess what happens? When David takes over Jerusalem and when Israel becomes one nation, guess what happens? All of these peoples, all these foreign peoples become part of Israel. Israel wasn't just a bunch of purebred Jewish people. What happens is when Israel comes together, all these foreigners become a part of this new nation. All these foreigners, the Jebusites, the Phoenicians, the Edomites, the Moabites, the Ammonites, the Syrians, and Philistines, and the Canaanites too. All these people become a part of this nation, and they're excited about it. And they're like, yeah, David's king, and he can do anything. And David is awesome, and everyone is very excited about David. Israel becomes the powerhouse of Palestine. This has never been done before. David is just carving new ground. And quickly what happens is all these people come together, all these nationalities, they have all these trades, all these gifts. And before you know it, not only is a new nation formed, a new economy is formed. And who isn't happy when there's money flowing? Everybody's happy. It's a new economy. And all these nationalities bring new economies, and then there's bunches of taxes. And taxes are being paid to who? They're being paid to David because David is the king. David is doing something's never been done before. And then David says this. David says, not only am I a powerful person, but here's what I'm going to do. Where's the Ark of the Covenant? The most holy embodiment of God. David said, where is it? And they're like, in the hill country. And it's been there and probably should stay there. And David's like, no, I want the Ark of the Covenant. And they're like, really? And David's like, yeah. The priest huddled together, the high priest, the Sanhedrin, all that. Hologar, not a good idea. David said, I don't think you understand. The Ark of the Covenant is coming to Jerusalem. Make it happen. They bring the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem. Now, not only is Jerusalem the most powerful city in Palestine, it is the holy city of Palestine. And not only now is David the most powerful, this is so important. Not only now is David the most powerful ruler in the world, he is now what? The most holy ruler of the world. He is. He is. When David said, bring the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, he became. It's true. The priests looked at him and they said, you brought it here. We told you not to, you brought it here. It's your responsibility. David said, I'll take responsibility for it. The high priest would look at him and said, you're accountable now. By bringing the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem, you are now accountable. The code of Mount Sinai now applies to you. David says, I'll take the code of Mount Sinai. I'll take the covenant of Mount Sinai upon me. And David now, his religious aspect and his powerful aspect, David is everything. If you go to the book of 2 Samuel, just so you understand how much David is, and it's so important that we understand that, go to the book of 2 Samuel chapter 7. This is how much David is. Prophet Nathan goes to David and says this. Now then, tell my servant David, this is what the Lord Almighty says. I took you from pasture, from tending the flock, and appointed you ruler over my people Israel. I have been with you wherever you have gone, and I have cut off all your enemies before you. Now I will make your name great, like the names of the greatest men on earth. How many people today in the world know the name King David? And God said all the way back then, I will make your name great. People will know your name. And that promise is true today. I will provide a place for my people, Israel, and will plant them so that they can have a home of their own and will no longer be disturbed. Wicked people will not oppress them anymore as they did at the beginning and have done ever since the time I appointed leaders. Over my people, Israel, I will also give you rest from all your enemies, the Lord declares, to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. And when your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, Jesus. And I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name. And I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father and he will be my son. And when he does wrong, I will punish him with a rod wielded by men, with floggings inflicted by human hands. But my love will never be taken away from him as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed from before you. Your house and your kingdom, David, your house, David, your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. Nathan reports these words, this revelation from God to King David. David is everything. With that, David is everything. Powerful, religious. He's been promised that his name will persevere through the years. He's been promised that his family seat. He is everything. Now, it was common in the day. In David's day, it was common that most kings thought of themselves as sons of God. In the Old Testament, the moral framework by which David is now placed is placed within that same framework. David is now firmly linked to the covenant relationship between God and his people that was established at Mount Sinai. David is now considered a son of God. The Old Testament says we're going to do this. He is now considered a son of God. He is now given special privileges. That prophecy gives him special privileges. It also means that in special privileges, it also means that with that came moral requirements of the Sinai covenant. And his position now as a son of God could mean that he would be disciplined. He would be disciplined only and punished only by God if he broke any of the Sinai covenant. Let me ask a question about what you know about David. Now, here we go. Dipping back in. Did David break the Sinai covenant? Did David have a big oops moment? Did David have a big oops moment? Bathsheba. Do any of you know about Bathsheba? In chapter 7, Nathan gives David the best prophetic blessing he could ever give him. In chapter 11, David meets a woman, Bathsheba. And there's a story there, right? And you know the story because that's one of the common stories we know. We know that in a very short amount of time that David's life would change because of his Bathsheba moment. And that story even has more layers to it. And you can go there and you can read about that story in chapter 11, chapter 12. Long and short, as soon David's life changes, his kingdom is split. His sons would be torn apart from one another. One son would wage war against another. One of his sons would be killed by a military commander. Another one of his sons would force him out of the palace due to humiliation. David's whole blunder, his whole oops moment would become public knowledge and he would be publicly disgraced. And as far as Israel is concerned, he would probably never be the same king that he was. Inevitably, because of his mistake, his sin, and God holding him accountable and God disciplining him, David's dynasty never lived up to the expectations that it was supposed to. His kingdom never became what it was supposed to. The prophet Samuel, who anointed David, had foreseen that this would become an issue. He prophesied as such, but it happened that not only David, but none of the kings of Israel would ever live up to the expectations that you're supposed to. As a matter of fact, every king after David would always err on the side of being more concerned about himself than that of the kingdom. And pretty soon, each king had violated their covenant obligations to God and their people. I said that each week that we do this series, a character is going to ask us a question. David would ask us a question this morning. And here's his question to us. He would say to us, he'd say to you and me, he'd say, what's your big screw up? What's your big screw up? What's your life-changing sin? What's the thing that you've done that's cost you, hurt, devastated, many around you? What's that? David say, what's that look like? You know what mine looks like. It's public record. You can read about it. I have nothing to hide. But David look at us and he say, what big opportunity have you blown? I blew it. What about you? What's the opportunity you've blown? How about you? David might look at us today and say, how have you ticked God off? What have you done to tick God off? I ticked God off. What have you done to tick God off? And David might look at us and go, and do you think that your story is over? Do you think that God doesn't love you anymore? Do you think that God isn't going to forgive you for your big screw up? For a big mistake? Did you blow it? I blew it. Have you blown it? Did you do something you're really, really embarrassed about? I did something I was really embarrassed about. I understand that. Have you done something in your life where you had it all and you did something stupid and it cost you everything? I understand that. I've done that. Have you done something just stupid in your life and sinful in your life and it's changed your future? I understand that. I did. And it changed my family's future in many ways. I understand that. David would say, so do you understand we're talking today? And do you have an answer to some of those questions that David asked you? And then David would say, yeah, we're not so different now, are we? Pretty much the same, aren't we? You, like me, have been given much in life. You, like me, have been blessed with much in life. You, like me, much of your life is because of God's goodness, right? David would look at us and say, you've been given responsibilities. You've been given a role in life, much like me, from God. And you've been given a role from God, too. And you've messed it up, haven't you? Yeah, I understand it because I have, too. And David would look at us and he'd say, but listen, look at what I did. Look at what I did when I came to account for my sin, my big screw up, my mistake. Look at what I did. And in Psalm 51, we see what David did. As the most powerful person on the face of the earth, this is what David did. In Psalm 51, he says, have mercy on me, O God, according to your unfailing love, according to your great compassion, blot out my transgressions, wash away all my iniquity, and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgressions, and my sin is always before me. Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. Yes, Psalm 51. David screwed up. He sinned. He messed things up. It was a mess. He confesses it in Psalm 51. Yes, David was conditionally disciplined by God. Conditionally disciplined by God, he was. God didn't let him off the hook. He conditionally disciplined him. But God also unconditionally loved David. Unconditionally loved David. That we have a God who, yes, he will conditionally discipline us. But he always unconditionally loves us. He always unconditionally keeps his promises to us, no matter our sins, no matter our mistakes, and they can be big. And he looks at us and he says, I will unconditionally love you, and I will always keep my promises to you. I want your name to be a part of the family tree. I want your name to be a part of this story. I want your name to be in Jesus' story. 999 years later, after David, comes a man in the line of David, and his name is Joseph. And Joseph would marry Mary, and they would go to the city of Bethlehem and become parents of the Messiah, because God keeps his promises. The story of New Testament, the story of Jesus, is that God makes a new promise to all people. Luke chapter 2, verses 10 through 14. Talk about the angel pronounces that a new promise has come, a new covenant has come, a new Messiah has come. Yet God has kept his promise, and God makes a new promise with all people. And just as the old promise to David was unconditionally kept by God, so the new promise that is coming would also be unconditionally kept by God. Next week, come in the morning service, 9:30 and 11, and we're going to celebrate that unconditional promise that's been kept by God. We're going to celebrate the birth, the life, the miracle of Jesus Christ next Sunday here. And we're going to hear the message that he has to share with us. And it's going to be glorious. And it's going to be wonderful. Dear Father, we come to you today. We thank you for David's voice speaking to us today. We've heard it. Psalm 51. Father, we come before you. We seek your forgiveness for our sin. We seek your unconditional grace and mercy for our sin. For sin that's been costly, sin that's embarrassing, sin that's unnecessary, but sin none the same. And we're tired of the weight, and we're aware of the price. And our sin is before us. We are not blind to it. Our hearts are ever aware of it. And so we come to you today, Father, in confessing our sin. May your forgiveness, your grace, your mercy, and your love heal us and strengthen us. Assure us that we are again, once again, brought anew into your covenant that you've given to us. In your name, Father, amen. I'll ask you.